What's better than watching your team win? Winning money while you do it. I'm Jim Costa, and on Cash the Ticket, Mike Valenti and I give you the edge to make every game playable. College football, NFL, we're breaking it all down game by game. Your podcast feed is going to be filled, and you're going to love it. You can click on the games you care about. We do it all. With our analysis, we're finding games that other people aren't talking about. We're turning every Saturday and every Sunday into days where you got a chance to win. Don't just sit on the sidelines. Cash the Ticket with us. Follow Cash the Ticket in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Washington Insider, Dave Leventhal. Dave, good morning.
Good morning to you, Joe Beamer.
Dave, it's been, you know, a very busy week, as it always has been with politics, as we are now less than 70 days till Election Day. So let's go to the big event Thursday night. No, I'm not talking about the opening of college football. I'm talking about the CNN interview with Kamala Harris. And this was made such a big deal, Dave. What did you make of the interview, and does it have any lasting effect on this election?
It was a big deal, first of all, because Kamala Harris had not conducted, since becoming the de facto nominee of the Democratic Party, any meaningful interviews, certainly not at a national level in a televised form in the way that she did it a couple of days ago last week, and had taken very, very scant questions that were extemporaneous, that were on the fly. Everything had really been sort of a tight production and very, very controlled, and not anything that allowed reporters or anyone else to ask her questions where she didn't necessarily have a predetermined answer. So, yes, normally for a press conference or for a sit-down interview like this, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. It wouldn't be a nationwide event of the sort that it was. But for those aforementioned reasons, that's why this turned out to be what it was. As for the interview itself, I mean, it wasn't all that interesting. I mean, not a whole lot of news that was broken. And if anything, if we learned anything, bottom line, it was that largely Kamala Harris is adhering to the policies of Joe Biden across the board, whether those be economic, whether they deal with the border. And maybe if we did learn some things, it was that she is taking less of a departure from the Biden-Harris administration, of course, of which she is still a part of, and has deviated a little bit, some might argue more than a little bit, from the presidential campaign that she ran in 2020. And a lot of people are like, oh yeah, she ran in 2020. It was such a brief and tumultuous and ultimately unsuccessful campaign that not a lot of people remember necessarily what she stood for, but she is definitely tracking more toward the middle than she was when she was running in 2019 ahead of that 2020 election, when some of her policies, especially around energy and even some social issues, were definitely a little bit more to the left than she's presenting herself as being right now, Joe.
You know, Dave, obviously she is the vice president. She's in the White House right now. Is that the kind of thing that can help and hurt her throughout this election?
It can, and it is a double-edged sword, and I don't think there's any two ways about that. At one time, she's trying to have it both ways, is really what it comes down to. On one hand, she is very much, and we saw this during the Democratic National Convention, saying, we will not go back. We are going forward. This is a path toward the future. Lots of rhetorical flourishes of that sort, with the arrow pointing toward the future, which is, of course, talking about Donald Trump, and that's what she largely means by that. But there's a subtle undercurrent to say that I am also a different kind of person than Joe Biden, that the things that dogged Joe Biden all this year and the things that ultimately led to his departure as a candidate, his pulling out of the race, the fact that he had been struggling mightily in communicating his message, that he had that awful and disastrous debate performance, that you're not going to have to worry about that with me. That was the message that she's putting forward. So it's kind of this dance where when she talks about the future, yes, it's about Donald Trump, but also it's about Joe Biden, while at the same time, Joe, not having really any major policy departures from the Biden-Harris administration. And yes, we've seen a little bit of daylight on a couple of issues, not the least of which would be the Israel-Gaza situation, where she has been perhaps a little bit more aggressive in her words and her vision for the way that should be going down and how quickly Israel should be seeking a ceasefire. But when you look at all the different policy issues, when you look at all the different topics that are being discussed and are hot in this particular election, the vast majority of things, there's just not a huge material difference between what Joe Biden stands for and what Kamala Harris stands for. So you can love that, you can leave that, you can hate it, but that's the way it is right now, although we still have 2 months and change here to go before Election Day, and there is the distinct possibility that the more Kamala Harris discusses these issues, that we will see differences. We just didn't see a whole lot of them in this particular sit-down with CNN, which, again, was just not terribly revelatory or anything. I mean, I think she was just trying to steer the ship, drive the bus, use whatever metaphor you want, and kind of survive to the next round without any big gaffes or really try not to make any news that was going to hurt her. Certainly, that seemed to be her strategy.
Now, there's also Tim Walz on this ticket, and he's been caught in a few stretching of the truth. How much can your running mate, again, help or hurt you?
Ultimately, if you look at history, the vice presidency and the vice presidential candidate usually just doesn't hurt or help you all that much. Now, things can always be different. You can always have those outliers. Tim Walz seems to be, on balance, a pretty net positive for Kamala Harris in the sense that he is cutting this very everyman Midwestern type of figure and silhouette in the campaign. And so far, he's been very well received by Democrats and potentially to some independents or some undecided voters. And that seemed to be a very significant motivating factor for putting him on the ticket in the first place, that he could appeal to those types of voters who ultimately, Joe, are going to make such a huge difference, an outsized difference in this election. Voters in the 7 or 8 or 9 swing states across the country, the Pennsylvanias and the Michigans and the Wisconsins and Arizonas and North Carolinas, et cetera. And Tim Walz can be a really positive surrogate for her, so she hopes. And at least so far, so good as far as the Harris campaign is concerned. But yeah, they can hurt you too if you have somebody who really steps in it. And Tim Walz has definitely had to deal with some slings and arrows about what exactly he retired at in terms of his rank when he left the reserves. And that's something that, you know, I'm sure the campaign doesn't want to deal with. But J.D. Vance, on the other hand, too, has had his share of issues too. So, you know, I don't know if overall, either of the candidates have really helped or hurt their top ticket running mates all that much. But it remains to be seen again when the two of them are very much going to be on the trail and very much front and center for both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, respectively, and are playing maybe a little bit more of a notable role than they would be otherwise, particularly with J.D. Vance in the sense that he's replacing another vice presidential candidate, and there's a little bit more spotlight on that, and that Mike Pence was jettisoned from the ticket, and he's the new guy. So there's a little bit more intrigue there. And Tim Walz, likewise, he's not a known commodity in the sense that he was a governor of Minnesota, not exactly a national figure. So there's definitely a lot more intrigue and some questions for him at this point, as opposed to if he had already been vice president or if Joe Biden was still running, we wouldn't have these questions necessarily about Kamala Harris, who's already been there and done that.
Looking at the other campaign, or the other big campaign, the Trump campaign, the first full week since the RFK dropped out and put his weight behind Trump. Also, Tulsi Gabbard saying that she will be endorsing Trump. No surprises there. But in this week, we heard some kind of interesting abortion takes from the former president that has pro-lifers and pro-choice people both upset.
Yeah, and abortion is a huge issue in this campaign, and oftentimes it's not, but it is now, and that's largely because of the way that the country is in terms of its laws and its policies regarding abortion. We were not talking about this issue in previous election cycles in anything but a Roe v. Wade status quo, which had largely been the law of the land since the early 90s when there was a big decision then, but going back and tracing back all the way 50 years to when the decision first came down in the early 70s. But now everything has changed, and the reality on the ground in so many states across the country, or at least a number of states across the country, is that everything has changed, and that what used to be a federal standard is now a state standard. And you have so many states, especially in the South in the country, that have actively changed their laws. So Donald Trump has struggled with this a little bit, in the sense that he has, whether you love Donald Trump or not, I mean, he's been all over the map on the issue of abortion all throughout his career, which dates back to before he rode the golden escalator down and announced that he was running for president for the first time in 2015. So he's doing his best to try to square that with where he's at this point, but also, too, he has made contradictory statements through the course of this campaign, which has been disquieting for particularly some people on the very far social right, who are like, no, this is not tenable. This is not something that we want. We want you, Donald Trump, to talk about having a nationwide abortion ban. We want you to talk in terms of that it should never be legal under any circumstance. And so when Donald Trump says something that is less than that, and Donald Trump is not talking in aspirational terms towards something of that level, then you get some folks on the right who begin to get agitated and a little bit upset. On the Democratic side, you don't have those issues, because the Democrats have always been very clear that they want Roe v. Wade to be the law of the land. Although there are some interesting little wrinkles, North Carolina being, you know, kind of a Bible Belt state, which is very much in play right now, very key, where that kind of a message from Kamala Harris doesn't necessarily play as well as it would in some of the other states around the country. But if you look at the polls and you believe them, most Americans want something that is going to be less than a total nationwide abortion ban. They do not want that. That is highly unpopular. And in fact, the converse is fairly popular at this point in time. So this is a moving target, and Donald Trump is very much dealing with that right now. And it's kind of unclear exactly where he's going to land, if he's going to land in a specific place in terms of a hard and fast policy that he would want to put in place on day one, or in the first 100 days of his second administration, were he to have another shot at the White House.
And it all gets to the question, Dave, that I've been asking you since I think the last election ended, and that's polling, because...
If your day sounds like...
We need the report ASAP.
You deserve Modelo. If you've persevered through... You deserve this rich golden lager with a crisp but refreshing taste. Or if you overcame...
Two more.
You deserve this ice-cold reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
It's not just about watching the game. It's about betting on it. I'm Mike Valeni, and on Cash the Ticket, Jim Costa and I break down every college football and NFL matchup like it's the last game we're ever going to watch. From the best bets to the sneaky underdogs, and of course, as my co-host likes to say, the value. And the one thing we're not going to do is pretend we're professionals. We have fun with it. It's an entertainment product, and it makes watching games a hell of a lot of fun. So Cash the Ticket, follow it in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It, you know, you've got all different kinds of polls. You've got all different kinds of pollsters saying one thing, right? You've got Polymarket saying something. You've got Nate Silver, who seems like his forecast changes every day. Does that just show us that this is closer than close?
So it's very close. And a couple things about polls. Number one individual poll is not going to tell you a whole lot. There are tons of different polls, as you just mentioned, that are taking place. There are different ways to measure the electorate. There are different styles scientifically in how polls are taken. I think the things that people should look at are two things in particular. Number one, look at the websites out there that aggregate poll numbers and give you a trend. Okay, so they're less of a snapshot as to what is happening here on September 1st of 2024, and more a, hey, this is how things are changing over time. This is the way the trends are going. I think there's a lot more information to glean from something like that than if you just look at the latest poll from Gallup or Quinnipiac or whatever the polling firm is or where it's coming from. And I was looking at, because I look at these all the time, the 538 aggregation of polls. And what it shows right now is that basically since Kamala Harris has gotten into the race, that there has been a gap that has opened up at the national level, where Kamala Harris is, from when you look at all those aggregated polls all put together, and you kind of, put them in a bowl and you stir and you bake it, she is ahead by a couple of percentage points over Donald Trump, and has been for the better part of August. And that gap has widened in the middle of August, and it's basically been maintained ever since the middle of August through the Democratic National Convention. So that is one thing to note. The other thing to note, too, is that we don't run our elections by national polling standards. We have the Electoral College. So, well, what does that mean in terms of polling? It means that those polls in those 7 or 8 or 9 key swing states are really the polls that matter. So it absolutely behooves people who want to understand this stuff, who want to study this stuff, who want to get real information from this kind of stuff, to look at the individual polls in the individual states, or the aggregation of the polls in the individual states. And I know we're getting into like statistic talk here and whatnot, and many people's eyes may be glazing over when they look at this stuff, but it is very important to see it. Is Kamala Harris or Donald Trump up or down in Pennsylvania? Are they up or down in Wisconsin or Michigan? That's where this election is going to be won or lost. And if Kamala Harris is beginning to open a gap in one of those states, that is going to that's going to tell you things that are much more important than national polls that include, California, where of course Kamala Harris is going to win, or, Alabama, where of course Donald Trump is going to win. Those states don't really matter for the sake of polling. It's the swing states that do. So pay extra, extra attention to those. And if you've never looked at a specific state poll, now's probably a pretty good time, Joe, to start looking.
I mean, it really does come down to Pennsylvania, right? I mean, Pennsylvania is what both candidates will end up needing. I mean, if you want to see a presidential rally this fall and you live in Western New York, your best bet might be to drive down to Pennsylvania.
Oh, sure. And Donald Trump is going to be spending a considerable amount of time there. He already has. This is Butler, Pennsylvania, the site of his assassination attempt. I mean, there are political reasons, there are emotional reasons, there are polling reasons, there are electoral reasons, there are win and loss reasons for Donald Trump to spend an inordinate amount of time in Pennsylvania, and you can absolutely expect that he will, and Kamala Harris to the same degree. Joe Biden was, it seemed like he was in Philadelphia, every other month during his presidency and during his time running for re-election before he dropped out. So by not only words, but very much by actions, Pennsylvania absolutely 100% is not where this election is going to come down to, but it could, and is absolutely 100% critical to the fortunes of one side or the other. I think it would be an overstatement to say whoever wins Pennsylvania wins the election, but it wouldn't be that much of an overstatement. There are lots of different paths and different ways you can do the math, but man, if one candidate wins Pennsylvania, it would be shocking to see them lose the election. Let's put it that way.
Dave, one more question on the presidential election, then I quickly want to ask you about Senate. But we also, on Tuesday, got news that the special counsel on the January 6th case will rework the indictment against Donald Trump in filing. What does that mean, and what does that mean for former President Trump?
Yeah, well, basically, this was in response to the Supreme Court's ruling a couple months ago that presidents, of course, Donald Trump being at the forefront, would be, in essence, immune from certain types of prosecution while they were president or executing the duties of their presidency, in short layman's terms. So what the superseding indictment was going back to a grand jury and more or less getting an indictment on the same things that Donald Trump had previously been indicted for, but stripping out some of the language and some of the material and evidence presented that, in essence, the Supreme Court ruling had deemed inoperative. So Jack Smith and the prosecution is going forward, but they're going forward with a much more tailored, and I hate the word bespoke, but it's probably apt here, a type of argument that they're putting forward, and they were able to get a grand jury to indict on. So in a way, nothing has changed, but it does mean that this case is not dead, not by a long shot, and is going forward just in a slightly different, altered form that is in direct response to what the Supreme Court had said. And that is not surprising. He pretty much had to do this if he wanted to go forward with the case.
You know, there's so much focus on the presidential election, Dave, but you do have the two houses. You have the House of Representatives, you have the Senate, you have the Senate, and the control of both are up in November. Why is the talk, or maybe it's just the talk I'm seeing, why is there talk that Republicans are likely to take over the Senate, and what states will we be watching November 5th?
Yeah, well, if you're just going to run the numbers, it's probably advantage Republicans in the sense that let's have the stakes here. The House, every seat is open, okay, and the Senate, and up for re-election. In the Senate, you only have about one third of the Senate, and two thirds that are not up for election right now because the Senate is on a 6-year cycle where the House is 2 years. So that's the playing field. Well, what does that mean this time around in 2024? What it means is that some of the seats that are open are just naturally more favorable to Republicans than they are Democrats. So the elections are being contested in states that are more red states than they are blue states, favor the Republican theoretically. And you think of a state like Montana, where John Tester, who is the incumbent senator, he's a Democrat, and he's a Democrat in that very red state. So because he's up for election this time around, that's a seat that potentially could flip and that Republicans could get, and that really bolsters their claim on a majority, ultimately, if that comes to pass. Ohio is another state, too, where Sherrod Brown, the longtime senator there, he's a Democrat. Ohio used to be a swing state, not so much anymore. That's more of a red state. So Sherrod Brown is running in a very tough reelection race to retain his seat. And if the Republicans pick that one up, that's two seats if they win Montana, too. And that's enough for a majority. So you can kind of see where this is going. And there are other states, too, that are very much in the balance. They are, I think we can call them toss-ups at this point. Arizona, where Ruben Gallego and Carrie Lake are going at it, the Democrat and the Republican. That one is very close, although Gallego may be up a little bit. The Texas race is a very interesting one, and that Ted Cruz, he's up against Colin Allred, the Democrat there, but still interesting. And then back to Pennsylvania, where Bob Casey, a Democrat running against Dave McCormick, the Republican, and Dave McCormick definitely has a very good shot here. He's somebody who, if he flipped that state, that's another one in the R column. So sorry to go through all the details, but that's really how the sausage is getting made this time around. And to the question of why is this sort of a advantage for the Republicans? Because they have more races that they could either flip a seat or they could retain a seat than the Democrats do. The Democrats are just simply going to have to get a lot more work done in order to maintain their Senate majority, which right now is just by literally a hair's breadth, and something that could happen, but something that's going to be a little bit more of a difficult path for them.
You know, Dave, it's so funny. We think of how divided, you know, how divided everyone's politics are, but then every 2 or 4 years, we're reminded, oh, yeah, there are some people who actually have split ballots, right, who might vote for Donald Trump but might also vote for a Democrat in Senate. We see it in Montana. We might see it in some of the other states that you mentioned. I think it's interesting. It reminds that not everyone views politics as just, divided and have to vote right down a straight line.
No, they don't. And it's critical to remind people of that, too, especially if they live in a state where that isn't happening. But you look at states like, Massachusetts, you think it's a blue state through and through, right? Well, no, they've elected Republican governors. And that's a pretty typical thing here close to Washington, D.C. And in Maryland, Larry Hogan is the Republican former governor. He was wildly popular when he was governor. He's running for U.S. Senate right now in another extremely close race where, a Republican should not have a chance to win the U.S. Senate seat, but that's a Senate seat that's open right now. It's about as much of a toss-up as any of the other states that we just mentioned. Angela also Brooks is the Democrat who's running. She's a county executive of Prince George's County, very close to D.C., and it's really anyone's race at this point. Larry Hogan could absolutely win that seat, and that would be another one in the Republicans' column, even if Larry Hogan is very anti-Donald Trump, and you know, a lot of people would consider him a Republican in name only, but that's still a Republican seat, and that makes a difference between whether the Republicans have a majority or are, again, in the minority. So, yeah, absolutely, that is the truth, and I think that you could expect in a state like Maryland there to be some ticket splitting where you actually have, in real numbers that make a difference, people voting for Kamala Harris for president but voting for Larry Hogan for the U.S. Senate. That may sound crazy, but it's not in a state like Maryland. That is going to happen, at least at some level.
Dave, I'm off to the Chicken Wing Fest at Highmark Stadium. You know, you're a Buffalonian. You're now in the capital city in Washington, D.C. Has your perspective on wings changed, not being in Western New York?
My perspective has changed in that I only desire them more and more, and the heart grows fonder with distance. But luckily, I'm going to be back in the city of my birth, my beloved city of Buffalo, for the Bills' home opener next weekend. So I have a feeling that I will be able to scratch that wing itch, although not in the fashion that you will today, Joe. And I am very happy for you and everyone else who will be going there.
Well, I will let you know who wins, and I'll be coming right back from Blacksburg, Virginia, to the tailgate next week. So I will see you next week, Dave. Have yourself a great week.
You as well. Go Bills.
Trying to figure out what to eat for dinner yet again? With Knorr Sides and Bouillon as your not-so-secret ingredient, you can skip the drive-thru and do dinner at home. Knorr Taste Combos provide a menu of delicious, affordable, and well-balanced meals that you can prepare in 30 minutes or less. Visit Knorr.com to get quick and easy recipe ideas for your home-cooked weeknight dinners. It's not fast food, but it's so good.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
It's not just about watching the game. It's about betting on it. I'm Mike Valenti, and on Cash the Ticket, Jim Costa and I break down every college football and NFL matchup like it's the last game we're ever going to watch, from the best bets to the sneaky underdogs. And of course, as my co-host likes to say, the value. And the one thing we're not going to do is pretend we're professionals. We have fun with it. It's an entertainment product, and it makes watching games a hell of a lot of fun. So Cash the Ticket, follow it in the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.